On this week in Enterprise Tech, we talk about how the FTC wants more power to go after those companies that are leaking your data. And Brian McHenry, Curtis, and I talk with Ian Iberg, CEO of NanoVMs, about unikernels and security. Twyatt on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for this week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twyatt. This week in Enterprise Tech, episode 302, recorded August 3rd, 2018. Unikernels and the death of the security patch. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Wasabi Hot Cloud Storage. Wasabi's disruptive cloud storage technology is helping enterprise solve one of the fastest growing issues, data storage. See for yourself with free unlimited storage for a month. Go to wasabi.com, click free trial, and use offer code ENTERPRISE. Welcome to This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that is dedicated to you, the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how this world is connected. I'm your host, Louis Moresca, your guide through the world of enterprise, but I definitely do not want to guide you by myself. It'll help for my friends, starting with Mr. Curtis Franklin, senior editor at Dark Reading. Curtis, you're almost up to 800 interviews now for Black Hat, right?
It seems that way. I was looking at my calendar, and it is a pure sea of green for meetings, interviews, and all kinds of fun from roughly early Monday afternoon until I get on a plane the following Sunday. My time is pretty well spoken for, but I tell you what, I'm looking forward to it. I've had some interviews already with some of the people doing presentations, and this is going to be an exciting week in the world of security.
That's awesome. I wish I had a chance to go. I just can't get away. But maybe next year. We'll have to live vicariously through you. Thanks, Curtis. Of course, joining our group of misfits here, of course, our newest co-host in crime, Mr. Brian McHenry, bam, from F5 Networks. Brian, it's super great to have you back.
Hey, thanks, Lou.
So you guys are working hard. I heard you guys are being leaders in web application firewalls now, right?
Yeah, a lot of good press around the advanced web app firewall release. We're actually gearing up. I'm going to miss Black Hat as well, which is a little unusual for me. But I am looking forward to the following week in Boston. F5's big customer conference called Agility is happening. And I've got a lot of meetings and gatherings and some presentations to do there, and it's always a good time.
Fantastic. Everyone gets to do all fun traveling. One of these days I'll be able to get away. Well, folks, we have a pretty great episode for you. Not only are we talking about the FTC and how they want more power to go after companies once they leak your data, but we have a great guest also, NanoVMs, to talk unikernels and securing your system. But we first, like we always do, let's jump into this week's blips. Now, you remember the days of the peer-to-peer file sharing networks surfaced by like LimeWire and Napster and other systems? You could share your music, your videos, and other files. And it kind of created headaches for the law enforcement due to the decentralized nature of the protocol. But law enforcers seemed to find ways to target enough people, especially the ones that started the software, in order to stop the use of the protocol. Well, there's a new rodeo in town, and that's Augur. It's a decentralized prediction market platform and protocol on the Ethereum blockchain that's owned and operated by the people that use it. Augur is marketed as an open source system that can predict the next election or short a cryptocurrency, hedge against your least favorite sports team. It also helps turn political knowledge into predictive power by trading the outcome of upcoming elections. It allows you to hedge against catastrophic events like natural disasters, market crashes, and geopolitical upheaval. Well, Augur and its prediction market is not without controversy, especially the part about hedging against the demise of celebrities. The decentralized technology also means decentralized control. No one person can single-handedly change Augur or shut it down. It sounds an awful like gambling, doesn't it? Well, federal and state lawmakers and enforcers are not too happy about Augur. Augur's creators claim they don't have control over what its users choose to do with the protocol or the ability to shut it down. Since it's decentralized, it's hard to enforce laws upon it. Now, lawmakers and enforcers will need to look to other ways to uphold someone accountable, like going after the software developers, like they did with Napster. Now, blockchain is the new hotness, and new laws and enforcers are about to come along with it.
A new Chrome extension alerts users to hacked sites. Now, nobody wants to enter their data on a hacked site, but unless you stay current on security news, most people don't know which portals are safe and which are potentially harmful. Now, a new Hack Notice extension for Google Chrome notifies users when websites they access have been recently compromised. Enterprises have access to services like PwnList, Security Scorecard, Shodan, and Metasploit to help protect them from cyber attacks, but most individual users don't have access to anything like the same resources. Hack Notice aims to arm people with more data to make choices about the businesses they use. It was founded by Steve Thomas, former co-founder of credential monitoring service PwnList, to make threat intelligence more accessible to the average user. With the Chrome extension, consumers can learn whether a website has been recently compromised before they submit any personal information. He said, "We are starting with Chrome, but we are absolutely open to other browsers," when he was talking about plans for the future. "We are already planning how to release the extension for Firefox. Here's hoping their plans extend to all the major browsers in the future."
Thanks, Curtis. Scientific American just published an article about IoT botnets. Now, IoT botnets have been around for a while, and they've been growing rapidly, typically via poorly secured internet-connected security cameras, among other devices, running common Linux distributions. The Mirai and Purserai DDoS botnets from a year or two back were the first major incidents of how dangerous a massive army of small computers such as those found in IoT devices can be. Recent trends show botnets like these being shifted from DDoS for hire, so-called booter services, to a new form of monetization, cryptojacking. Cryptojacking, also known as crypto mining, is the process of compromising a server or device for the purpose of loading crypto mining software. These IoT devices usually have the processing power to generate a fraction of a penny per day. But at the massive scale these botnets are at worldwide, those partial pennies can add up over time. More ambitious attackers will also target poorly secured public cloud virtual servers, which have access to a lot more processing power. These attacks tend to share one thing in common: default or reuse passwords, making the hacking effort really trivial.
Now, in other news, more blockchain. So Curtis did predict it was the year of the blockchain, and now we all know that there's money being made off of our information. Well, the new blockchain startup Alpha Token isn't going to take it anymore. They're developing a new web browser, starting with Android and iPhone, that lets you stay in control of your data as you surf and search the internet. It even lets you track your uploads, YouTube style, and where they go. Now, users utilize public and private keys to digitally sign and secure transactions within the system. The use of the blockchain technology allows users to transfer any type of information from web surfing to file sharing. Now, for now, the new Alpha browser is invite only, but beta testing and adding content to the network is happening every day, which is seeding the system. Now, one day soon, it will be ready for the rest of us. I have a feeling Richard and Pied Piper might want a piece of this new tech, too.
Hey, is Reddit going to finally kill SMS two-factor authentication? Earlier this week, Reddit disclosed a serious intrusion that fortunately didn't result in a massive data loss. Instead, according to Reddit's engineering staff, quote, "We suspect weaknesses inherent to SMS-based two-factor authentication to be the root cause of this incident," end quote, an incident that exposed old user data and hashed credentials. In its announcement of the scope of the breach, the firm encouraged fellow security professionals to move to token-based authentication. The way Reddit was breached is a common attack that takes advantage of unwarranted faith in SMS-based two-factor authentication. How well known is that weakness? Well, NIST Special Publication 800-63 Guidelines recommends restricting the use of SMS for OTP and advises completely removing OTP, or one-time password, generation via email. Still, some security professionals correctly argue that SMS-based two-factor authentication is better than nothing. Ilya Kolachenko, CEO of Hightech Bridge, said, quote, when most business-critical applications have serious vulnerabilities varying from injections to RCE, two-factor authentication hardening is definitely not the most important task to take care of, end quote.
And what does cyber insurance really cover? In a news item reported on by both Slate and Krebs Security, high-profile compromises have become more commonplace. Many organizations sought cyber insurance policies to protect them or mitigate the risk of losses in the case of a data breach. The National Bank of Blacksburg in Virginia lost $2.4 million combined in two different data breaches in 2016 and 2017. When the bank made a claim on their policy with Everest National Insurance Company, the payout was only $50,000. The bank is now suing the insurance company for breach of contract. The cyber insurance industry is booming. Since data breach notifications became mandatory in most U.S. states in 2005, the market for cyber insurance has grown from about $180 million all the way to $1.5 billion in 2015. Insurance giant Aon projects that this will grow to almost $6 billion by 2020. I called this out in an article on informationsecuritybuzz.com a couple of years ago, but the big catch in these cyber insurance policies will be providing due diligence about what defines a loss due to cybercrime versus other forms of theft. The point of contention in this case being whether this loss was the result of cyber attack or a debit card slash ATM compromise. If your organization is considering cyber insurance or has a policy in place, I suggest you take a close look at the fine print to ensure that your cyber threats and risks are very well aligned with the policy fine print. Don't let those insurance companies off the hook for paying out just by having a technicality.
Now, we're all familiar with Duo Security. We've had them on episode 297. We talked a little bit about Zero Trust and SSO. And they've even helped Cheebert on his SSO dongle woes. Well, this latest news shows you just how cutting edge and relevant our guests and topics are. Cisco announced Thursday it will buy cybersecurity company Duo Security for $2.35 billion in cash and stock. Now, Cisco security business grew about 11% in the fiscal third quarter, almost three times the rate of the company's overall growth. Still, security accounted for only 4.7% of total sales, as Cisco continues to count on hardware like switches and routers for the bulk of its revenue. Well, it's now time to start worrying about security. Well, Cisco felt that the private cloud security software company, which prevents security breaches on devices, was well worth their weight in gold. Of course, Duo Security is also a sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, that does it for the blips. Next up, the bites. And of course, we have a pretty good set of them. But first, we have to thank a sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's Wasabi Hot Cloud Storage. Now, you might be saying cloud storage tends to get expensive the more you store on it and the more times you actually access it and perform operations on it. And in this day, it tends to be true. The cloud storage competition sees how low they can get their storage fees and the ingress and egress fees. But these things and many more is where Wasabi Hot Cloud Storage prevails. Now, if you think about it, a lot of these systems, when you go down in price and tier, you tend to lose reliability and performance. Well, if you're doing small personal projects to large enterprise projects, Wasabi seems to have figured it all out. Listen to this cost. 0.49 cents per gigabyte per month. That's only $4.99 per terabyte per month. Plus, listen to this game changer. Unlimited free egress and no charge for API calls, so you don't have to pay to actually access your data. Now, you should go check it out, what you're already paying right now for cloud storage, because I can tell you not having the include egress fees or the API calls for CRUD operations will substantially save you money on cost of doing business. Now, if you're probably thinking, well, if they're cheaper, they must be slower, or they don't have as many features or bells as whistles, right? Well, Wasabi has really developed some disruptive technology here. They have ways to actually pull raw performance out of their storage devices without compromising anything. They have a revolutionary process that lays data on disks sequentially as opposed to block. Now, what happens? Well, that means Wasabi storage is 80% cheaper and six times faster in speed than the industry leader. Now, are you and your organization worried about compliance? Well, Wasabi is HIPAA, FINRA, and CGAIS compliant as well. So you get fast, cheap storage, but isn't it worth it actually isn't worth too much if you have fast and cheap storage if your data isn't secure. Well, Wasabi has an answer for this as well. Wasabi offers a unique feature of immutable buckets that cannot be deleted or altered, thus protecting valuable data from accidentally or maliciously destruction, which is not available with competing solutions. Plus, they have a 90-day rotating integrity checks, and they have 11 nines of durability. Now, if you're worried about data migration to the cloud services, Wasabi also has an answer for this. They have the Wasabi Ball Transfer Appliance. Now, this thing is powered by Netgear, and it's designed to transfer super large data sets while dramatically reducing your costs and, of course, improving speeds. Now, you might already have a cloud storage, right? Well, you might, your organization might already have something, right? Or your organization might be trying to store data on-premise at some point to save costs, maybe if your own, or maybe even own your own colocation data centers, because maybe cloud services are costing you too much. Well, Wasabi will have you think about that again. I bet you are ready to try this out, right? Well, go build something fun or move some of your data right now. Experience Wasabi for yourself with free unlimited storage for a month. Go to wasabi.com, click the free trial link, and enter the code ENTERPRISE. See how much storing in the cloud can save your business. That's wasabi.com and enter that code ENTERPRISE. We thank Wasabi for their support in This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, let's jump into the bites. Now, when it comes to data breaches, sometimes it's hard to handle the fact that companies, when they leak your data, there's really no way to hold them accountable unless you pony up some cash and civilly sue them. Well, one way the EU is actually fighting back is using GDPR. Now, currently, the FTC kind of lacks sharp teeth here when it comes to fighting back against privacy and data security issues. In fact, the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, they want some power back. They want to fight back, and they're looking for ways to actually increase their power and regulatory authority, including the ability to enforce civil penalties when it comes to data security. Now, since 2002, the FTC has gone after over 60 companies. Now, they believed to have engaged in these companies potentially have been engaged in deceptive and unfair cybersecurity practices or didn't protect consumers' data. Now, they weren't always successful in these cases, like in the case of LabMD, which this company actually failed to protect the security of their customers, including their medical information. And in the data breach, they had over 10,000 people actually affected by this. Now, the FTC thought they had won when a federal court actually tried to force LabMD to change their security practices, but then a repeal ruling happened. And the FTC was ordered, the order against them was actually ordered to be removed from LabMD because it was unenforceable because it mandated a complete overhaul of LabMD's data security program while failing to detail how they were supposed to do it. Now, I wish I had Denise Howell on the show again because, I'm definitely not a lawyer here. But this sounds like the court decision for LabMD has essentially set up FTC to fail or constrain them in the future because it seems like they won't be able to impose any broad or comprehensive cyber programs on companies without providing specifics or appropriate to the context of the situation and how to correct them. Now, this basically requires the FTC issue orders with great detail and also depending on the facts of the case. Now, that sounds expensive and consuming. Now, time consuming. So I want to throw this over to Curtis first because we all know at this point, like the FTC really hasn't much had too much skin in the game right here, right? They haven't really been regulating too much in the industry.
Very true. And, you know, this is one where normally I'm in favor of some government oversight to make sure that things don't get out of hand. But in this case, the way they went about it was, in fact, I think deeply flawed because they did essentially say, go change everything without giving any sort of guidance about what kind of changes would meet their okay. So LabMD was in the situation of having been told to change everything. If they did so, there was nothing to say that the FTC couldn't come back at the end and go, well, no, that's not what we meant. Change it again. And the court has said, if you're going to require changes, you have to give more guidance in that. You have to tell them where they're going, and if not, how to get that get there, at least what you want to see done to make it successful. And I think that's reasonable. You can argue that the commission and other commissions should have more resources to put into making these judgments so that they can, in fact, study the issue and give the organizations very concrete guidelines. But that's a separate issue. That becomes a budgeting and congressional oversight issue. In this case, I agree with the FTC in terms of the broad goal to make consumers safer. I just think the way they were going about it in this case was deeply, deeply flawed.
Yeah, I agree. I think they're essentially trying to chip away at the system rather than actually having a framework or a protocol or a bunch of regulation to kind of manage it. And even I don't think that it's sustainable. I mean, it won't. This process technically won't scale if you think about it, because every situation is different for every company. And so if they have to go through in their suits and say, hey, like, this is how you're going to go fix your particular situation, it's going to be expensive. And not only that, it's going to be time consuming. And it's going to take up their organization's time, and so they can't go focus on other bigger fish. So I guess I'm going to throw it over to you, Brian. I think, you know, in this case, you know, there's a, you know, when it comes to security and breaches, you know, there's a ton of different ways companies can have this problem, right? I mean, you probably see this firsthand, is, you know, there's not always one solution or one thing size fits all sort of thing, right?
Yeah, so a couple of the blips this week actually highlight that, right? The cyber insurance one that I covered, as well as the note from Curtis around two-factor authentication, and they noted like RCEs and big vulnerabilities are all out there. And so what, you know, at the end of the day, what describes due diligence? The payment card industry or PCI has attempted at some level to try to establish what's in scope, what's out of scope, what represents a significant risk to cardholder data. And there's probably a model in there somewhere that the FTC might be able to adopt. But probably, you know, what you said, there's a lot of variations. And there's a lot of organizations, because they never had to handle credit card data, are probably being a little bit lax with their approach because they didn't foresee any risk of like fine or legal action for negligence. Now, there are some laws on the books, as I mentioned. Since 2005, most states have data breach disclosure laws on the books. So there are things, are ways that some of this stuff can be actionable. But again, it's not real clear. It's not real clear what's the minimum due diligence to secure a web application. What's the minimum due diligence to secure a point of sale terminal in a store? You know, we have some ideas. And the other thing to consider is the more regulations you put around these types of things, does it hinder people from starting business? Does it slow down innovation? What does it do to stop these things? So there's a very fine line here, and there's not a clear cut sort of this is the best right way to move forward. But we do need to do more to establish what is due diligence and what is a good job of securing a customer and you know individuals' data.
Right. Now, I want to quote actually the FTC's chairman here, because he says it pretty interesting. The commission must continue to prioritize, examine, and address privacy and data security with fresh perspective. One way in which the agency plans to inform its work is through the recently announced hearings on competition, consumer protection in the 21st century, which will begin this fall. The commission's remedial authority concerning privacy and data security will be a key topic in these hearings, and the comments and discussions on these issues will be one source to inform the FTC's enforcement and policy priorities. Now, it sounds like, I mean, it doesn't seem like they really have a plan here other than that they're going to go and discuss it and let's maybe, hey, talk about potential regulation. Curtis, what do you think? I mean, it's time that they need to actually point out, hey, maybe it's time for us to point out something like GDPR or something to start protecting customers' data.
Well, I think that something like GDPR would be amazing. I also think that it hasn't a snowball's chance in hell of being implemented in the U.S. I mean, even with California's much, much, much more limited version of consumer privacy, some industries are running around like their hair's on fire. What I do think we could use, you know, to be honest, is some organization, and I think NIST is probably the right organization to do this, to set up some additional standards. You know, they do define security for the government. And I think if they were to broaden their mandate to look at defining security, defining privacy for non-governmental organizations, then that would be a reasonable starting point for bureaus and agencies like the FTC who wanted to have a basis for making regulations. Frankly, as I said, I don't think we're going to get that. What I suspect we're going to have for at least the next half decade or so is a patchwork where privacy is added little by little through precedents set in court cases. But let me throw in one wild card here. You know, privacy, much of it is based on what's called the reasonable man standard. In other words, what would just a reasonable citizen think is private? What would a reasonable person think is adequate security to protect that privacy? And things like Facebook and Twitter and other overly sharing social networks are changing the definition of what a reasonable citizen might think is private. So look out for that to be used in court cases as well. I've heard a couple of legal experts talking about that, and that really is the privacy wild card in the U.S. that is going to disrupt a lot of these efforts to regulate things.
Right. So, and Cheaper's actually in the chat room, and he's saying, you know, listen, we need to establish a minimum security checklist that at least companies have to kind of go through to say, hey, if we're going to maintain customers' data and make it secure, we have to follow these, at least these minimum checklists, or we're going to get sued for it. So I think that's interesting. I want to throw it over to you. I mean, we were talking a little bit about GDPR. Would that help? Is that going to be helpful for us if we ever tried to implement that?
Well, I think it's helpful. I think it's a guiding sort of way to move forward, say this is possible. This is what we could possibly do to establish better privacy and security standards. Now, the problem is that a lot like other standards we've seen in the past, like PCI, which I mentioned, you can say you're compliant. I think the old joke is that every credit card data breach that's ever happened, they've all been PCI compliant according to the company, but according to PCI, they weren't compliant. So who do you believe? And that's the issue, right? Does you know, establishing a policy and letting users know what your privacy policy is mean you're doing the work? I don't know. I don't know if the answer is there, but I do think establishing policies will help raise the bar and create awareness. I think ultimately, though, consumers and users are going to have to vote with their dollars and say, you know what, this isn't acceptable. This isn't an acceptable way for you to do business, and I'm no longer going to give you my business. We're going to need to see users and large organizations choose services based on the security that they offer, based on the privacy features that they offer and guarantee, rather than just choosing the least cost or most feature-rich service. They're going to have to look at security and privacy and vote with dollars. I really think that's the way that we're going to see things change. And I think we have seen some of that change when there have been big data breaches and some businesses have suffered financially due to that. And you see actions being taken by their competitors to not be in that same headline, as well as the actual breach victim themselves not wanting to have that happen to them again. In terms of reputation lost and loss of customers, loss of revenue.
Right. Yeah, I definitely think that hitting their pockets will definitely hurt if customers kind of say, hey, I'm going to leave this system or this service. The only downfall is, you know, with some of these suits, if you look at some of the suits that the FTC actually went up against, they actually showed the fact that some of these companies actually have privacy claims on their site. They say, hey, we do this with your data. We keep it safe, that kind of thing. The key here is they just never are being held accountable for it. I mean, they lose data, they're breached, or they make things insecure, and they're just not being held accountable. And I say if they're held accountable more often, even from a civil perspective, I think they'll start to actually change their ways. But again, this is just a one-off thing. I think a little bit of legislation might actually force them along the way. Now, there is a couple questions in the chat room. Curtis, I want you to I want to throw over to you. Is there really any supporting legislation today to help support some of this?
Nope. And frankly, in the current Congress, I don't expect that there would be. We are currently in a very anti-regulation or limited regulation Congress. I suspect that will be the case as long as the current Congress exists. It's going to depend heavily on what happens in the off-year elections coming up this November. If there's a dramatic shift in the makeup of Congress, then there might be an appetite for some legislation on future regulation, but that would almost certainly set up a battle with the White House. And the real question is whether either side has the stomach for a real battle over something that they see, frankly, as a minor issue. You know, when you compare this kind of privacy regulation to things like taxation and healthcare and other things, there just aren't an awful lot of politicians willing to stake a great deal on this topic.
Right, right, right. Makes sense. Well, again, only time will tell here. We'll see what happens here in the coming winter when or fall when the FTC starts taking charge. Well, folks, that does it for the Bipes. Of course, it comes to my favorite part of the show. It's when we bring in our guest to the and helps drop some knowledge on the Twiat Riot. And today is no exception. We have the CEO of NanoVMs, Ian Iberg. Welcome, Ian, to Twiat.
Hey, how's it going?
I'm doing fantastic. So there's a lot of disruption in the market right now with the fact that companies are moving to containers and enterprises thinking, hey, like I really need to start scaling my data better and making more sense, maybe even more securing, right, or securing our data. Can you maybe go through, you know, containers are kind of the hotness in infrastructure scaling right now. Are there misnomers here? You know, are we saving costs with containers? Are we securing our data more? Is that why people are moving more to unikernels and other things?
Yeah, you know, containers get compared to unikernels too often, I think. They're fundamentally completely different beasts, and we kind of contend that containers are even less secure than a basic virtual machine, because even the name container gives you this false sense of security. It's like it's supposed to contain something, but it doesn't contain anything. It's trivial to break out of them. So it's kind of a false dichotomy. But yeah, unikernels are starting to see more attention, especially on the security front, simply because of the inherent operating system defects that they prevent.
Right. So like, I think maybe just go over a little bit about what unikernels are, just maybe the technology behind them, and kind of if you can maybe compare the difference between that and containers, that'd be helpful.
Sure. Yeah. So at the end of the day, I assume probably most of the audience is aware of a virtual machine, which most of our software is being deployed to today, whether you're public cloud, private cloud, somewhere in the middle with hybrid, whatever you want to call it today. Most of our software is virtualized, and containers kind of take this abstraction further, and they break it up into each different process. Unikernels, on the other hand, at the end of the day, are usually deployed as virtual machines. And so, you know, in our unikernels, there's no Linux running underneath it. There is no Windows running underneath it. It's literally just your program running on top of the hypervisor. And you cannot fork new processes. So shellcode exploits go out the door. Remote code execution attacks, they go out the door. It's a single process system. And it's sitting directly on top of the hypervisor.
Right, makes sense. So it's essentially just, it's a customized version of the OS that you're kind of a la carting based on capabilities. So that makes, is that kind of simplifying a little bit?
Yeah, it's a rough thing. What it really is the realization that, you know, if we deploy to, say, Linux today, you know, say it's a web application, we're deploying to a system whose design concepts were largely made in 1969, 1970, you know, roughly 40, 50 years ago. Not much has changed since Ken Thompson and Dennis Ritchie started working on Unix a long time ago. And you have to realize that the systems that they were working on, the PDP 7s, the PDP 11s, these systems cost $500,000 in today's money. And they took up the entire freaking wall behind me. Like, they're huge. So they had to support multiple programs because they had to support multiple users using these computers. But you fast forward today in 2018, when this is being filmed, and we have virtual machines everywhere. Even small companies here in San Francisco, 20-person companies, they'll have like 100 virtual machines that they're managing. And they're splitting these VMs up into one program per VM. And obviously the container abstraction takes that further. And so our question is do we really need a full-fledged general purpose operating system that's filled with security holes serving up these applications? Do we really need to give attackers the ability to run their software on our systems? And unikernels are saying, no, we don't need this capability.
Right. So Google's actually quoted, they have a project, I think it's internally actually, the gVisor project, where they're essentially running containers in isolated VMs. Even some of the VMs have been hardened in some cases to make them more secure. Does this help for containers? Like, does it make it even closer? Or, you know, do you think that they'll just never get to what unikernels are possible doing?
Yeah. So I'm glad you brought this up. gVisor is a really interesting vindication of what we've been preaching. gVisor is Google's own admission that containers are inherently insecure abstractions. Google is on record of saying that any container that they run is already backed by a virtual machine because they don't trust container technology to deal with the security aspect. And gVisor, the way they implement it, there's basically two methods. One, they resort to KVM, which is the hypervisor, of course. Or two, they resort to ptrace, where they intercept every single system call. The problem with the ptrace abstraction is as anybody who knows who's used ptrace before, is that it's incredibly, incredibly slow. Like, so slow that it's simply not a production worthwhile endeavor. So I find gVisor interesting just simply from the fact that Google is saying, hey, we know containers suck, and this is an option if you really care about it.
Right. So let's talk a little bit about the fact. I think there was some call out the fact that unikernels tend to run at the ring zero access to the OS. And that's concerning because that means that they have much lower level access. And if you run some malicious code on there, you're in big troubles. So does this create any more issues for unikernels in that case than maybe containers or just standard VMs?
Yeah. So I'm glad you brought that up. It's a common criticism that is brought up by various people every now and then. The criticism that it's running at ring zero is completely unwarranted for a couple of reasons. Number one, if we were deploying unikernels to real hardware, which we aren't, if we were deploying unikernels to real hardware, yes, you have that abstraction to where you can just crash the server and now you have a crashed server and it's on hardware and all things go wrong. But that concern goes away because we're inside of a virtual machine. So that's one thing. Another thing to think about is like, oh, you're running in ring zero. Therefore, you must be able to attack other programs on that system. Once again, this concern is completely unwarranted. Why? Because unikernels are single process systems. They only run one program per VM to begin with. And so that concern goes out the window because we're not like Linux where you go to Amazon, you go to Google, you boot up a Linux Ubuntu instance, you immediately have 100 programs running even without you installing a single thing. So unikernels, you boot up that instance and it's just that one program. If you have a Drupal installation, your PHP interpreter is a unikernel, then your database is a unikernel, and maybe you have a load balancer in front of it. That's a unikernel. So each program is isolated into a VM. So the ring zero thing, that's just a misconception that people have because they actually haven't utilized the systems yet.
Makes sense. So you kind of talked about this a little bit, about performance and the fact that like unikernels, they do different performance. Now question is, how different in performance are they for the containers or standard VMs?
Good question. They're ridiculously fast is the answer to it. Some researchers are booting unikernels in about 5 milliseconds. So to kind of tell you how fast that is, Docker, containers boot in about 100 milliseconds. So multiple orders of magnitude faster than a container. And obviously a normal Linux or Windows VM, seconds to minutes, which is just light years slower. So boot time is incredibly fast, but runtime is also much faster. So there's, and one thing to clarify is that there's many different unikernel implementations out there. I can count 10 different unikernel implementations, and not every one is made equally. But generally speaking, since it's a single process system, you start getting rid of this context switching that happens. And there's two forms. There's from kernel to user back and forth. So we're talking every single packet that comes into your network and every single disk write that hits the disk, that's a kernel to user traversal. And unikernels typically, in most implementations, remove that traversal. This massively, massively speeds up your systems. Microsoft themselves have measured this, and they've said that this costs 30 to 40% performance hit. And it's just something that engineers have to live with because they haven't really dealt with anything else. So that's one form. But then the other form is I spoke that of Linux systems and Windows systems, they have hundreds of programs running. And so it's an illusion that these programs are actually running at the same time. It's not. They're switching back and forth really, really fast and pretending to run at the same time. And so that's an extra cost that unikernels get rid of. And so you can run things like databases like Cassandra. You can run things like MySQL, Nginx, name the software. It's going to run faster in a unikernel implementation.
Right. So to touch on a little bit on security, I think I wanted to throw it over to Curtis because he has some questions. We talked about a little bit about in the past on our shows about the Apache Struts vulnerability for Equifax, yeah. Some of these other vulnerabilities that systems have. And, so I'll throw it over to Curtis.
Yeah, I'm curious about how the microkernels deal with being on separate cores and with the speculative execution that especially, that the Intel architecture is doing. Are each of them, absolutely in their own memory space, or are they kind of subject to the same kind of speculative execution issues that most of the mainstream operating systems and environments have been shown to be susceptible to?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I'll say right off the bat that they're totally susceptible to Spectre-like attacks. We can't prevent problems that are present in the hardware, right? So I'm not going to pretend we can. What I will say is that the patches that have been introduced to deal with these attacks, like Spectre, they incur massive performance penalties when applied. And so when you couple that with unikernel performance advantages, you have that inherent benefit coming in there. Likewise, the attack vectors are completely different. So if we look at how you would attack through, say, a Spectre attack, you're either coming in through the hypervisor or you're coming up through the guest, right? And so if we're coming up through the guest, that implies that you have things like a shell, implies that you have some other sort of access to that guest VM so you can attack the other VMs. And so that's not present in unikernels. So that vector of attack kind of is diminished, right? And then the other way, coming in through the hypervisor, if you have control to the hypervisor, say you have control to Amazon's infrastructure, good luck, we're all screwed, So...
Okay, well, let me continue on the hardware-based issue, and it sounds like with a scheduler, you might be able to put each of these unikernels off on a separate core. Is that something that you can do so that you really can start taking advantage of these, multi-core processors that are in so many of the servers?
Yeah. So to answer the question, we actually already pin our processes to cores to begin with. And we just do that for other reasons, performance mainly, and also management reasons. But the orchestration system that we've kind of developed, we do that naturally. That's not really a unikernel thing. That's more of like how do you manage the VMs type of practice, though.
Well, my last question then is that if you can pin to a core, does that indicate that in the future you might be able to go off and run on GPUs so that you could get some really massive implementations going?
You know, we haven't personally looked at GPUs, but there's definitely interest. Not only GPUs, but other different non-x86 architectures. You know, RISC-V is definitely something that we've been sniffing around at, for instance.
So, Brian, you had a question about security, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I come more from a network and web application security background, and I'm thinking, all right, so we contain, say, the Drupal network listener or you know, Apache network listener in a unikernel, and that certainly reduces the scope of what you could actually compromise if you actually compromise that instance. Now, what I'm very interested in is like these network-based attack vectors or application-based attack vectors. If I come in and there's an Apache Struts like vulnerability, you know, and my goal is not to compromise the machine itself, but rather, compromise the data. Does this help me in that regard? Does it help mitigate that risk in any way?
Yeah, and I'm kind of glad you brought this up because I think a lot of people don't really understand how some of these attacks work. It's one thing to say, oh, I have this exploit, but it's another thing to understand exactly how the hacker is working. So, I kind of have a long security background. I was one of the original 14-year-old, so to speak, you know, getting into these servers. And so I have a very good idea of how these guys work. And when we look at Apache Struts, vulnerability that affected Equifax, we look at exactly what's going on. It's not necessarily the fact that they were able to find the flaw in the system. The same thing with Drupal getting. It wasn't the fact that there was a flaw in the form sanitization function. Bugs like that happen all the time. It's a part of the software development lifecycle. It's going to happen. It's expected to happen. What should not happen is the fact that I can run my program on your computer because I was able to fork a shell. That's the problem. And that's what unikernels solve. Because who cares if you get control of EIP? You know, it doesn't matter in a single process system. What matters is that you're able to download new code. You're able to run your code on that end system. That's the problem. And when you kind of remove that problem, you start to realize that you start solving a lot of security issues right off the bat.
Yeah. So what, let me see if I can clarify this in my own head is, what you're saying is like really what attackers are actually trying to do when they find a vulnerability is, really just chain that exploit into another exploit so they can land software. I mentioned in the blips about crypto jacking and crypto mining, right? So they're using Apache Struts right now to land crypto mining software. So is that what you're getting at? Is that there's you're really going to mitigate that impact?
Yeah, half the time the attacker doesn't really even care what software they're attacking. They're just looking for their way onto your system. That's all they care about. I mean, that's why they employ these mass scanning, looking for looking for Struts, looking for the Drupal version that's affected. They don't care that it's that particular bug. They just know that they can scan for it. They can pop into this system, land, then download their crypto mining code and start running that as another process, another program. That's all they care about. The exploit itself, the bug in the software, you know, that's just like them picking the lock to enter your house. Then they open up the garage and they drive in the van and start loading it up. That's the problem.
Right. So I want to do a little bit of a shift here. Like, I think there was a little bit of some criticism in the field around, I think it was a CTO of Joint that said, hey, like, listen, unikernels are very useful, but there's not a lot of tooling around them. So there's a lot more tooling around VMs and containers. And so there needs to be more of community involvement here, more useful organizations coming up and developing tools. And so it makes it harder for them right now to be utilized. Is that true? Is that things are kind of turning around for unikernels?
Yeah, I think so. You know, the whole debugging argument's kind of ridiculous. And it kind of depends on what context of debugging you're talking about. I'll say this, before we were working with unikernels, we actually ran an application performance monitoring company that produces the software. And guess what worked out of the box in a unikernel when we booted the first Go unikernel? That's right. We were able to see all the panics. We were able to see all the garbage collection, memory, everything. And then, you know, Brendan Greig, who also worked with Brian, you know, like a week after that blog post came out, he showed flame graphs of him debugging and profiling unikernels. And, you know, our own unikernels, we use, you know, if we're debugging the kernel side itself, we use GDB like any normal person would for a C code base. However, if it's one of the interpreted languages like Ruby or Python, you know, the same debuggers work just as well there. All the observability tools, if that's the way the conversation swings, you know, every tool that I've kind of checked out works out of the box. So I think it's a very unfounded criticism coming from the containerati, because they do kind of they are kind of disappointed that that ecosystem that they built up could be kind of completely swept away if unikernels kind of took off as an infrastructure paradigm.
Right.
So that's a pretty bold statement.
Which one?
Unikernels could kind of sweep away the container paradigm.
Yeah, I mean, it's I'm not really. I mean, I have no interest in the container stuff. So it's that's just, I think, what a lot of people see, and I think that's where some of that criticism comes from.
So I think one of the interesting things that happened with containers that pushed it to the next level of utilization in a lot of large organizations, it went from sort of these side project things where people were trying to spin up things quickly and it was easier to deal with in a virtual machine. And then it went from, you know, sort of Skunkworks lab tool to main production tool was management and orchestration suites like Kubernetes that make it possible to deal with the really large number of containers that tend to end up being instantiated. Now, I could see unikernels being a lot more unikernels, like an order of magnitude more unikernel instances than container instances, which begs the question of management and orchestration suites, not just debugging, but actually, you know, keeping track of everything that's running and being able to spin it up and down when needed in a way that's meaningful and aligned with what's going on in production environments.
Yeah, I think we do see people starting to explore with things like serverless, function as a service. And I think those abstractions are going to kind of deal with the orchestration issue there. So, you know, there are other orchestration frameworks out there. The people that we mainly deal with, they're mainly dealing with VMs that are instantiated for, you know, a given lifetime, at least up until certain code changes. But then there's also installations where it's, you know, a database and it just sits there for months at a time, or a year. So it kind of depends on what you're working with, but there are unikernel companies that are working with serverless type of stuff.
So are there specific integration points for nano VMs with things that, you know, our listeners might already be using in their organizations? Or is there a way for them to get started and start to peek into this technology and figure out how it can help them solve some of the problems that you've talked about?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, if there's any security concerns, that's definitely something to be looking at. Likewise, if you're wanting to eke out some performance from, say, a database or a web server, you know, not spending so much on Amazon, for instance. I know a lot of your listeners who might be Amazon customers might have $20,000 a month bills, might have $100,000 a month bills. You know, that's largely because of the way developers instantiate virtual machines today. And it's not because we're dumb or anything. It's just those are the tools that we have, and you know, we're trying to use the hammer, and we should be using a screw gun type of thing. So any web-based application software makes a great fit for unikernels, web servers, app servers, databases. The whole microservices movement, that fits hand in glove with unikernels.
So what's the tip, you know, so for a typical, you know, web application, how many unikernels am I looking at for, you know, database, app server tier, you know, what's that footprint look like? How many services, how many unikernels am I spinning up?
Well, you know, I would say that it's going to be 1-to-1 depending upon your VM workload today. Because once again, if you look at how developers are actually pushing out their applications, they're already isolating programs per VM. These are the web servers. These are the database. These are the queue servers. These are, you know, whatever it is. They already isolate them per VM anyways, except it's in this big honking monolithic operating system that's filled with security holes. It's not patched and, you know, has 1,000 different ways to screw the company over. Yeah, I mean, I think it's the exact same abstraction layer. If you have 5 web servers sitting behind a load balancer, that's the exact same sort of situation that you would have in the unikernel land. Likewise, if you have 50 microservices sitting as Docker containers, you would have the exact same number sitting as unikernel. So it's going to be kind of 1-to-1 on that. Except, you know, considering the performance of these things, you might be able to decrease the amount that you have.
What about cost? Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm good. Yeah.
Okay.
Let's talk about cost.
Talk about a little bit of cost too. I think, you know, there is a misconception. Obviously, people are using VMs right now. Their costs are quite high. You know, when people even move to containers, sometimes their costs tend to go up. Right. And so that the same for unikernels too? Or?
So that's one thing that we run into all the time. You talk to a lot of the shops that have adopted containers en masse. And one of the talking points that is said was, hey, this kind of decreases the DevOps cost, which is a real cost, especially here in San Francisco Bay Area. You know, it decreases this DevOps cost, and it's simply not the case. You look at them and they go out and hire 10 DevOps people, which is incredibly expensive. So on the human side, it's expensive, but then also just on the raw infrastructure, it's expensive because you adopt your container system and then you got to stand up this service mesh, and then you got to stand up, you know, the secret store, and you got to stand up this, and everything has to be clustered, and then all of a sudden you have 60 instances and it's serving one web server. Why?
Right. Interesting. So let's shift just for a second. We're close to running out of time. I wanted to talk a little bit about IoT as well. So, like, for instance, Raspberry Pi and other things, because there are some, like, unikernel, like Mirage OS on Raspberry Pi, running the Xen hypervisors. So they are running VMs. Is it possible for nano VMs to be running on IoT, or do you see customers doing this?
So yeah, it's a great question. It's not, we don't necessarily mess with IoT at all. You know, basically if it's Intel x86, we'll touch it. If it's ARM, you know, V8, something like that, we leave it to other unikernel companies that do exist. And so I think IoT is a great place for unikernels. You look at all the botnets out there. How are they built? They're going after routers, cameras, you know, all these unpatched Linux systems that are just sitting out there. Some of them have telnet, for crying out loud, on them. Okay, most of them have telnet, right? And if it's not telnet, it's some SSH, you know, and it's completely ridiculous, completely ridiculous. I have a security system in here. It's running Linux. For all I know, it could be a part of a botnet because that's how stupid this has gotten in the past 10 or 15 years. So IoT components make insanely great use cases for unikernels. And there are definitely companies working in the space provisioning unikernels on these devices. And interesting enough, they're not just, you know, flashing the device. They are running things like Xen on them, mainly for management reasons.
Right. Well, folks, we've run out of time. You've done it again. You've sat for another hour with the best dang enterprise tech show in the planet, according to 9 out of 10 unikernels. But of course, I want to thank our panelists for dropping some knowledge on the Twilight Riot, starting out with one of my co-hosts in crime, Mr. Curtis Franklin. Always a pleasure to have you, sir. Can you tell the folks at home where they can find you, your work, and where you're headed next?
Well, next week you can find me, my work, pretty much all parts of me out in the desert. I'll be at Black Hat and then DEF CON all of next week. I'll be tweeting heavily, so follow me at KG4GWA if you'd like to keep up on all the security goodness and scariness going on out there. As always, you can find my writing at Dark Reading. Would love to have you take a look at what I'm writing and leave your comments. Let me know what you think. You can always find pointers to that, once again, on Twitter, KG4GWA.
Fantastic. Thank you, Curtis. Hopefully what happens in Vegas doesn't stay in Vegas because we want to hear about what's going on. So we're looking forward to it. Of course, we want to thank our newest co-host in crime, Mr. Brian McHenry. Brian, can you tell the folks at home where they can find you, all of your work, about Fat Five and all that stuff?
Absolutely. Thanks, Lou. First of all, head over to devcentral.f5.com. That's F5's community site. I blog there fairly frequently, as does my team in customer solutions engineering as well. On that point, we're going to be in Boston at F5 Agility, not next week during Black Hat, but the following week. So if you're in Boston and you want to meet up, definitely look me up. And the easiest way to contact me is right there on Twitter at BA McHenry. Walk up, say, hey, Bam, I saw you on Twilight, and I'll definitely be willing to sit down and chat. Back to you, Lou.
Fantastic. Thanks, Brian. Well, of course, we want to thank our guest, Ian. Great show. Thank you for being here. We wanted to give you 30 seconds just to tell the folks at home where they can find you, all of your work, and a little about NanoVMs.
Yeah, so you can find us over at nanovms.com or on Twitter, LinkedIn, a few of the social channels out there. You can see us at Black Hat. We'll be at Black Hat next week, and we'll also be back in Vegas, unfortunately, for VMworld 2 weeks after that. So, you know, stop by and say hi if you're in town.
Fantastic. Well, it's always great to have you here, and I think that we'll definitely want to have you back because we want to hear a little bit more about how the nano VMs are beating the container market. Thanks again. Well, of course, we also want to thank you tune in each and every week. We couldn't do the show without you. You are our loyal listeners and followers, and we love that you're here. We want to make it easy for you to watch and listen this week in Enterprise Tech. Of course, go to the show page right now, twit.tv/Twiat. Find all of our back episodes, our latest episodes, all the show notes, guest information, of course, all the links to the stories that we do during the show. And more importantly, next to the videos is that magic button up there that says subscribe. And of course, you can subscribe to the format of your choice, audio, video, HD video, and of course, on the device of your choice, whether it's phone, tablet, laptop, or desktop. And after you subscribe, we want you to definitely share the show with your friends and family and coworkers because we love doing this show. And with your support, we can continue to do it. After you subscribe, remember we do this show each and every week at 1:30 Pacific time right here on live.twit.tv. Come to see how the pizza's made, right? See how goofy we are all around here and what's going on in the background. Of course, if you love joining the show live, you're going to love joining our chat room live, irc.twit.tv. We get a lot of questions. In fact, Chibert's in there right now, haggling the chat room, trying to get him to ask questions. We actually got some great questions from there today. So jump in there, be live, come help us with the show. Of course, I also don't want to forget, you know, everyone that makes this show possible. Thank you to Leo and Lisa for letting us do this show each and every week and supporting us. Of course, thank you to our tireless producer, Mr. Brian Chi, and of course, to all the engineers on the show. Now, also, don't forget, if you want to follow me and some of my interesting discussions that I have, go to twitter.com/UMM. And of course, you can always find my work that I do during my daily work, my daily job during the day at dev.office.com. And before we sign out, of course, I have to thank my TD for today, Alex. Thank you, sir, for filling in. You know, we have to continue the tradition here. So I guess I'll just ask you, Alex, can you tell us the just main topic of the show for today?
Oh, geez, that's a good question. What do you think? I don't really remember, but what do you think it is?
I think it was networking.
Networking. We think it's networking.
Fantastic. It's great to see Padre there. Well, unfortunately, both of you are wrong. It's how fast containers are. No, wait. How slow containers are compared to unikernels. But maybe next time we'll get you. And until next time, I'm Louis Moresca saying, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep quiet.